Assassin's Creed Mirage, Dune Part 2, and 21 High Stakes Heists. This is Staying In.
We're coming out of the spring doldrums, I guess, where, you know, because there's light now in the mornings and light in the evenings as well, which is quite exciting. And I have needed little pick-me-ups here and there in my mornings to kind of get me through. I've been trying to reduce my caffeine intake recently by having no caffeine. Yeah. By having low caffeine coffee and tea. So like some of them like decaffeinate and some are just really, really low. And I've got to say, they've done coffee. Well done, scientists. Well done. But tea, it's really? Not quite there yet. It's not quite there yet. Decaffeinated tea, like normal breakfast tea I'm talking about.
Yeah.
Decaffeinated tea just is not it doesn't touch regular tea.
Well, no, because it's not got caffeine in it.
Well, no, but like decaf coffee tastes like coffee.
Okay. Have you given it a fair shout? Have you tried different brands of decaf tea? Because I can personally recommend Yorkshire decaf tea.
Okay, I haven't tried Yorkshire decaf tea, yeah. Mostly because I think Yorkshire tea normally tastes like absolute garbage.
Okay.
What's your ideal tea of choice, Peter?
I'm a tips man, then.
Okay, yeah.
To sound interesting.
Yeah, I do like a PG tip, so you like a strong brew. You're not messing about.
I do, and... you know, that's if I've got the choice. Most of the time, we prep for, because we're fancy, we shop at Sainsbury's.
Okay.
We go for a Sainsbury's red label. But if I've got the option, if somebody's coming up to me and saying, what kind of brand do you want? I'm saying PG Tips first, Tetley second, and then long distant third.
Oh, Tetley second.
Oh, yeah.
I'm someone, you guys spend a lot of money on like, games and board game stuff. I don't. I spend my money on tea, so I go with Twinings.
Ooh.
Oh, yes, Dan.
Twinings is my standard. A Twinings extra strong is the way I sit.
Oh my word!
Do you also shop at Marks and Spencer's on the regular, or
I just to go in and get my Twinings.
Yeah, yeah. Big Marks and Sparks bag, like
bag with one box of Twinings in it.
Just in for the usuals. For foreign listeners, Marks and Spencer's is a very up-brand supermarket that only the richest of the rich shop at, and also Dan.
It's between Sainsbury's and Waitrose, if you want to think about the league table.
Yeah, you know what? It is, isn't it? It's always a playoff at the end of the season, isn't it? Between Marks and Sparks.
Who's going to get relegated?
Yeah. Although I have now... kind of hopped aboard the loose leaf tea train.
Yes,
yeah.
And I have to say, because like it was always a bit of a faff. The whole idea of loose leaf is always a bit of a faff.
It is.
And I like my English breakfast tea in the mornings. Yep. You have your decaf coffees, Pete. I stick with my caffeinated. I have my Twinings strong in the morning.
Good.
And I'm fine.
Yeah.
I've dabbled with herbal teas. I've dabbled with peppermint. And my issue with peppermint was it smells brilliant. Tastes horrible. I always had that issue.
Yeah.
And then
it's literally what I'm drinking now.
And now I've discovered actually how you use loose leaf tea. And suddenly I've had a mint tea made correctly. And it actually came from where Chris and Sam came to see me, and they were like, oh, I'll have a peppermint tea, please. And typically what I would do is I'd put the tea bag in there, I'd put the boiling water on top, and I'd hand it over to stew for as long as the person should wish. But alas, I was told that is incorrect.
Yeah, it is.
In fact, you need to let the water cool a little bit and then you add that. So, mind blown. Now, loose leaf tea, let the water cool, then put it in my little pot. And suddenly, oh my God, I like loose leaf tea. I like mint tea. Who would have known?
It's a different
whole new
world
has opened up to me.
Yeah. Yeah, it is a different world, isn't it?
I can.
Do you think people realise we're a British podcast?
Yeah, well, I think they've got... I mean, if they haven't after this...
I mean, to be frank, we've had 200 episodes of our chat interspersed with sounds of tea being made.
That's true.
It's about time we just spent some concentrated time talking about tea.
Now, I can recommend to both of you an even looser variant of tea, which is the powdered form, which is matcha tea. So, Pete, I'm a bit like you. I've tried to cut my caffeine. I have one caffeinated drink a day, and currently it's a matcha tea. And rather than getting that single spike, which you get with a regular cup of tea, or especially a coffee, this gives you a slow release throughout the day.
Ah, and I see. You see, yeah, I wouldn't be looking for that, Chris, because I want spike.
You want
over and over again.
You want that roller coaster.
I really
downs.
Do. I really do. He wants to line up seven cups of tea and then boom, 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 boom.
Yeah, I don't want slow release energy. I want anxious but faster.
That Pete, if you are looking for a title for your memoirs.
Anxious but faster.
The Peter Willington Story. Volume 2. Oh my word.
Oh my wordly word.
So we're nearly 200 episodes in. I've just completed a game which represents 15 years of a particular series.
Go on.
Which is Assassin's Creed Mirage.
Okay, right.
I knew you would have things to say about this, Pete.
Let's get some things out of the way. First of all, I am probably the world's biggest Assassin's Creed fan, except for...
I know you are.
Except for maybe I'm not now, because I haven't played Valheim, because I...
Valhalla.
Played Origins.
Yes, because it doesn't exist.
Yes, of course, that's right. Valhalla. I did play Origins. I did play Odyssey.
Yep.
Uh-huh.
And by the end of those two games, I thought they were really good, but I was also basically sick of having like progress metered out to me through that weird RPG system, which I know they got better with Valhalla I have heard that Mirage does away with a lot of that stuff as well, but I've not played either of those. I would really hope that they have, because honestly, I've kind of churned off of a series that I've played most of the entries in.
They have, actually.
Really?
Which is one of the reasons I'm talking about it now with you, because typically, when I pick up an Assassin's Creed game, I start, like, literally January the 1st, I'll pick up and, you know, I usually start an open world game to kick off the year. And usually, I'm not done until after about 6 months.
Yeah.
I'm done now, it's March. I've played around just shy of 25 hours on this game, and I'm done with it.
When you say done with it?
So I've completed the story. I've found all of the various little treasures and little rewards that you can get in each district or area of the game map.
Wow.
Just done it. Just completed it.
Is it? Okay. Now, to some people, that would be like, ooh, less game. But to me, I'm like, ooh, less game.
So I was a bit anxious about this because I really love big open worlds to get lost in, because I have a little certain pattern I go through where, as I'm playing the story, I will alternate between side quest and main story to kind of basically make sure that I'm overpowered for each level that I'm, you know, that I'm attempting, really.
Yeah.
And then once I've completed the story, I look forward to just listening to a podcast, an audiobook, and just going for a wander around that world, having a little bit of an explore, almost like I'm on holiday, and mopping up, essentially, completing each of the areas of it, really. So I was quite anxious when I heard, oh, we're doing away with the stuff from Origins, Odyssey and Valhalla. I think, all right, because I actually quite like those games. I quite like the RPG stuff, because I play really quite rarely more than 4 console games a year, because the nature of my job, I play it in very small doses. And as a consequence, I really love that experience where you think, yeah, I've got this game now. I know the controls. Oh, what's this coming? Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Give me more of that, please. More and more of that, please. Yes, yes, yes. But I was a bit anxious. Whereas, actually, I've done a full U-turn. I really enjoyed Mirage. Because, Pete, it boils everything down. Take Valhalla, put it in a pot, and let it boil away. Well, Dan can tell you how long it should steep for.
Yeah.
And it will just steep away, and it will reduce down to everything you know and love. And they've done this deliberately. And it's not necessarily this is going to be what they're going to be doing moving forward. I think it's more of a homage. It's honouring the fact and recognising the fact that it's been 15 years since the franchise began. Mm-hmm. So Assassin's Creed, Pete, can you just give us a little bit of a summary of what Assassin's Creed is about? Because I've not been at it for, been with it since the beginning.
Yeah, sure. So it is an open world, often stealth. Though later games kind of did away with a lot of that stuff, action game in which you play either a Templar or an Assassin, which are two factions going up against one another in an unending war across time. And the kind of key personalities in the games, other than Ezio, which was part of the trilogy of two, it's a whole thing, the personalities really are the locations. So the reason people really love the fact that they got to go to Egypt in Origins, for example, or in the original game, we went to the Middle East, we went to like Jerusalem and those sorts of areas, Constantinople, those sorts of areas, and it was the start of the whole Templars, you know, Templar Knights and assassin, the Shashashin, I think they were called back in the day. So think Metal Gear Phantom Pain, except a lot more about traversal, and I would say equally weird in some ways.
Yeah.
Me and Pierre have a running joke about Assassin's Creed, which may have been kind of mentioned in passing over the length of this nearly 200 episode podcast. I really love the idea of the Assassin's Creed games. They really ticks every single box for me. Yes. And I remember, Pete, you getting me to play the first one, me playing it and thinking, oh, I can't get it. There was, I can't remember what it was, but there was like a fundamental thing that was a problem with it that I couldn't get over. And mm-hmm. you were like, totally agree with you. Play Assassin's Creed 2. They fix that. All right, brilliant. So I'd play that. But there'd be something else that was a real problem. And you'd be like, yeah, totally get that. Play Assassin's Creed. And this would go on game after game that you would always say, yeah. And there was an element of like, I know there's this bad thing, but they do fix it later on. And I kind of went for that. Probably got to like Black Flag, which I think was Assassin's Creed 4. The only one I've gone into since was Odyssey. And that was because obviously you'd kind of fallen in love with it.
Love that game.
And actually I got on really well with Odyssey because I think it expanded it more. You had more to do. It wasn't just in one little location. My issue was always, for one, I'm not very good at games. So when you have to try and hide from people, and I couldn't do that. So like I would like try and creep up on someone and they'd spot me and then I'd have to run away for 10 minutes. And then I'd have to try again. And they'd spot me again. And I'd have to run away for 10 minutes. And it became a bit of a chore. Whereas I didn't get that with Odyssey. So I'm interested to know, Chris, if you were to explain to someone who's perhaps never played Assassin's Creed, what is it about Mirage that has worked for you kind of so well? What is it that makes it a good game?
So Pete put the nail on the head, hit the nail on the head when he said about the world itself. It's Baghdad. This is Baghdad. Huh. Yeah, it is. It's extraordinary. 9th century Baghdad in what is known as the kind of golden age of Islam, which I must confess was a period of history that I was a complete ignoramus on and still am to a degree, I must admit.
So this is basically the period of time, because I know very little about it, but I've studied a little bit. This is the period of time where basically the nations of Islam essentially save Greek philosophy from going away forever.
Yep.
Like they invent a ton of stuff around mathematics, astronomy, algebra.
Literally.
Right? Like they invent tons of stuff.
Yep.
And it's just kind of glossed over. And it really was a golden age within that area. And obviously, you know, we now associate Baghdad with usually very negatively in because of, you know, recent times and the sort of things that have happened there. But yeah, it was the center of the civilized world at one point.
Yeah. and also in terms of its contributions not only to science and mathematics and astronomy, but also literature.
Yeah.
This game goes really hard on that. Like, you know, astronomy and literature and science are not just side quests, they are interwoven. So you will find fragments of poetry. And something that I've loved, I think this started with Assassin's Creed Origins. There are these little floating nodes where you pick up history. You know, you'll go to a marketplace, for example, the bazaar, and you'll learn all about the different history of it. And it's amazing. It's really, really interesting. And they put a lot of effort into kind of the historical research they conduct. So, and this is a living, breathing city. And what cemented it for me was it was some bird crap.
Cool. Yeah, good.
So,
good.
Like, as is quite common in games, to kind of show movements, you'll go to an area and you'll disturb some birds and they'll fly off. But also underneath it, they've put like bird crap there to kind of show you that, yeah, this isn't just something we've just rendered now. This is to kind of suggest or imply you're part of a larger ecosystem here.
Oh.
And one of the worries that I have sometimes, Dan, with Origins, Odyssey and Valhalla was, as you say, if you're caught, because the game map is so massive, you just feel like you're running through empty space and people are just chasing you until they give up. Whereas here, I was not running at all for long. I always had somewhere close by to hide, even if it was a crowd. I could sit on a bench and it says, okay, you're going to blend in, and people just run past you, you're blended in. Or I walk amongst a crowd and I blend in amongst them. And the moment I started to think about this game less as a typical game and more like, okay, if this was real life, what would happen? The more actually I found it more palatable. A good example of this is as follows. So typically of an open world game is you're wandering around. It doesn't matter where you are. Oh, I'm just going to talk to this friendly person who's going to give me a mission. Once they've given me the mission, I'm just going to walk around their camp and just rob them.
Yeah.
And I never get my comeuppance for that whatsoever, because I'm used to that, these kind of open world RPGs. Anything that's there to be taken, it's up for grabs. I will just take it.
Yeah.
What this does, which I believe the original Assassin's Creed games do, is if somebody sees you take some money, ooh, you've got a little wanted thing at the bottom right-hand corner now, like GTA. If you do something else bad, like, say, kill someone, and that's witnessed, you won't be able to go anywhere now without being seen. And you think, oh, great, well, so I can't kill anyone. Well, yes, you can, but just don't get seen, which is actually very easy. And secondly, what happens is, as soon as you're caught, Dan, wanted posters appear around town. You just need to rip down one and suddenly everything's cleared, pretty much. And I quite like that sense. And there'll be people talking around the poster. And just as they're about to say, oh, hang on, aren't you the... Oh, sorry. Also now, there's this additional currency where you get merchant tokens or power tokens and scholar tokens where you can bribe people. So like, there's like town criers dotted around. And if I've got a lot of bad press, I can just say, look, mate, just say something nice about me. Don't talk about me. Just talk about this other stuff. And they'll source it for me. Or I will bribe the merchant where I buy all my kit from. So if I get enough stuff to pay them, they're always going to permanently give me 30% discount on anything I buy there. So that a typical mission is you essentially saying, okay, you've got to get in here and either kill someone or steal someone. And depending on the mission, you may be asked to kind of get in and out without being seen or just not to get caught. So what tends to happen is you send up your eagle, which has been, you know, a kind of a motif in most, if not all, Assassin's Creed games. You map out the area ahead. You mark all the targets. You look for shortcut secrets in, secret ways in. Say, oh, maybe that merchant can get me in, perhaps, if I bribe them. And then you sneak in. And there's one additional mechanic in this game, which is really helpful. At the bottom of the screen, there are these empty bars. As you assassinate people with this little blade, this concealed blade you've got, you build up that bar. And over time, I had up to like 5 bars. And that basically means if I'm in a situation, there are 5 guards, I can push in the R3 on my controller and it basically goes into slow motion. And I basically mark all 5 of those people and basically press X to launch. And I just jump and you see me in slow motion take out all 5 of them like that.
That's cool.
But oh, like there's also like the blow darts to send them to sleep. And you're thinking, well, what's the difference between that and a blade? Well, there's a massive difference, because if somebody sees a dead body as opposed to somebody who's asleep.
Yeah.
Because I used, early on in the game, I would make a mistake. I'd see someone on the edge of a wall and think, oh, this is great. I'll just blade them in their back and that'll be it. But of course, they're going to fall to the ground and their mates are going to find them. And then the alarm's called.
Yeah.
So go again. Blow dart them. And the RPG, the only RPG elements that remain, Pete, are just the tech tree, which is very simple. There are three tech trees, one to essentially increase yourself, one to increase your assassin, and I cannot remember what the third one is. But basically it meant that when I threw blades now, daggers, the enemy would just dissolve. And I wouldn't need to actually get rid of the body or anything like that.
Wow.
So each upgrade you get just makes everything so much slicker. And the confidence you feel, which usually for me would take place after about 120 hours or 100 hours or something, now taking place in just over 20 is amazing. This feels to me like the perfect admixture of the old and the new.
I mean, when you talk about the old and new, like, that is the original game. Like, the things that you're describing there, the tearing down the wanted posters, you know, actually it being about planning your way in, your way out, like, that was the first game. And the sequels played some of that stuff down, and they played it down more as time went on. It's really fascinating to hear that they're going back to that kind of gameplay. And like you say, who knows if they'll keep it going. But yeah, that's kind of wonderful. That actually makes me more interested in playing going back now.
It's interesting because this was supposed to be DLC for Assassin's Creed Valhalla, because the character you play, Basim, appears in Valhalla as a non-playable character who meets Ivor in the UK. But somewhere through the development, they think, no, this could be a full game.
That's wicked.
And this is from Ubisoft Bordeaux. It's the first time they've led on a game project.
Yes, it will
be. So hopefully we'll see something interesting coming out of them from this as well.
That's really cool.
So I had a lot of fun with this. It made me realize, almost like pixel density on a screen, actually how much in an open world isn't about scale, it's about density.
Yeah.
And having the opportunity to go from a very beautifully dense Baghdad where there's those lovely affordances which just aid the parkour, where you can basically just stay on the rooftops going across ropes, swinging round on like pulleys, this sort of thing, to then getting on a camel and just riding through the desert.
That's cool.
Just brilliant. Oh, sorry, actually, I've just realised. Hang on, bear with me a second. Sorry, Pete, I've just bought your RPG.
Chris, thank you so much.
My pleasure. I'm sorry it's been this late. I always need to get to it.
That's absolutely wonderful. I am over the moon to hear that, genuinely, because... I did. I don't think I talked about it much, did I, with you folks? I just kind of got on with it and did it, and then I think towards the end of it, I showed you bits and pieces. But yeah, I've been working on a game design, which is new to me, as in I don't really do game design. So I mostly do like scenario design, which is more about like storytelling and setting up narratives and all that sort of stuff. But yes, I was part of Drive-Thru RPG's Pocket Quest 2024, which is a game jam held online. So we talked about jams before. This is where you get like a set period of time, and it's all around one event, and there's usually a theme, and then you make the thing, and it's usually a bit more experimental than like a big full commercial release or something along those lines. And yeah, you work towards it. And Pocket Quests this year, they've done this a few years now. I think this is the third, maybe the fourth one that they've done. The theme this year was heists.
Oh, one of my favorite themes.
Exactly. And I thought to myself, well, I've been doing a lot of heists over the last, you know, 2 or 3 years. because we've been playing Blades in the Dark.
And yeah, you haven't just been robbing banks.
Yeah, no, we've not been robbing banks. And
not stuff. Because you've become a criminal.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. So I made a game called 21 High Stakes Heists, which is, if I had to boil it down, and I do, it's essentially Blackjack as a role-playing game in which you rob a casino.
Love it.
Yeah. So this is a game design challenge in that I had to quote unquote come up with the mechanics. Spoilers. It's 21. It's Blackjack. But what I do is I take a bunch of those mechanics and twist them and make them more about character traits. And then you play games of Blackjack, and that essentially helps you resolve the scene that you're trying to get through. So for example, the dealer, which is the name of the GM, the dealer will say, okay, you're in this situation whereby you're walking down the hallway and you've not been challenged yet because you're in the back rooms of this casino. And then a guard who's on patrol comes along and asks you, you know, what you're doing back here, you know, do you have permission to be back here? And then the idea is like something like a Blades in the Dark or what have you, the idea is that you can either go back in time and set something up. So there's no such thing as like a flashback mechanic or anything like that. It's just the dealer encourages players to think along those lines of, did you set something up earlier to deal with this? Or you can try and bluff your way through it, in which case, depending on how good your bluffing is, maybe that requires a gamble action, which is playing the game of Blackjack to find out how the scene resolves. Or if you're really smart and really thoughtful, or you've moved through the game in a really sensible way, you don't have to do any of that stuff and you just get it for free because, oh, you picked up a name badge and you just flashed them. You know, earlier you did pick up a name badge. You flash the name badge and say, don't you know who I am? And then because you've done really good role playing there, the dealer just says, oh yeah, okay, cool. Well, then you get to move through without doing a gamble action. At the start of the scenario, you are given as a group 21 gamble tokens. And the gamble tokens are used for each player to enter a gamble action, i.e. to play a game of cards, i.e. roll a dice like you would in Dungeons and Dragons or something.
Yeah.
And the idea is that as that 21 stack goes down, essentially that is essentially acting as a timer for the whole scenario. Once those 21 are gone, if you haven't done the objective, it's game over, you lose. And the scenario plays out in that you failed.
So this was Pocket Quest on DriveThruRPG, where I know you've done a few things on there, haven't you?
Yes.
Done, and obviously the great game that was about the hot tub.
What's better than a hot tub? Yep.
So what time frame were you given for putting this all together?
So you get some advance warning if you're part of the Discord community that, you know, this Pocket Quest thing is coming up. And I think it's in the newsletters as well. And then they announce the theme and then they give you a month.
Right.
So you have basically 1 month. And obviously you need to know what that theme is to be able to create something based on it, because otherwise it's very obvious if, you know, you've made a product that's, you know, 6 months old and you just saved it for Pocket Quest. So you get about a month.
What the kind of... I'd probably say either restrictions/requirements of that. What do they stipulate outside of saying you've got to make a game about heists? Go.
Yep.
Like there must be a framework that you have to you must have to like tick a set of boxes. It's not just one guy who scribbled down on a bit of paper and handed it in and said, Here, it's a heist.
Well, here's the thing, it's you sort of can. So you have to stick to the theme. It has to be 25 pages or less. And that can be A5, A4, A3, A1, if you really wanted it to be. So it needs to be 25 pages or less, and that includes front cover, back cover. it can't be based on something called, that they call community content. So I make community content under the Call of Cthulhu Miskatonic University license, which is basically like Chaos Sim says, you can make a game, you can make some content for our game, but it's under the Miskatonic license, Miskatonic repository. So you can't make it under the community license. So it can't be that, it can't be Dungeons and Dragons, can't be any of those, because those are all community licenses. But it can be based on open game content. So for example, if a game is Creative Commons and you take all of those rules and you put them into your game, that's fair, because that's basically like it's completely open, so you're allowed to do that stuff. It has to be a completely self-contained game. So you have to be able to play the whole thing with one book. The theming tends to be around rules light. So they tend to make you want to do rules light stuff. But kind of, oh, and obviously, you know, like no super mad content that's just going to be not fun for people. Decency and all that. But other than that, there aren't really that many restrictions. You have to upload it all at at roughly the same time. You don't set it live. You have to fill in a little form that says, here's where it is. This is my publisher account. This is what I do. This is for Pocket Quest. You don't even have to use any of the like template formatting that they provide. So they do actually provide you everything. It's really cool. So DTRPG partnered up with Storytelling Collective, which is the Storytelling Collective is the group that I did my first Call of Cthulhu scenario with. That's the one that I did Catcock Collection under. And DTRPG have partnered up with them this year to help out with their Pocket Quest stuff. And what they've done is the two of them have basically given you a template so that if you don't know how to do layout or anything along those lines, you can just take theirs and just fill in your stuff. If you don't have an artist, you can just go and get a bunch of free art, or there's the Discord community where you can say, hey, anybody want $30? Like, I'm looking for this for a front cover, right? Like, there's loads of people they're trying to lower the barrier to entry because there's loads of people who want to get into pen and paper related design, because it's a really good way to sort of stretch the imagination without having to know, deep technical knowledge necessarily. So there's tons of that.
And yeah, I'm glad you spoke about the art, Pete, because you've commissioned an artist for this particular work.
Yeah.
And the artwork is really, really striking. So who is your artist and how did you steer them, I suppose, really? What guidance did you give them, or did they have carte blanche?
Yeah, this was wicked. You're not allowed to use AI in your writing or your art for Pocket Quest, which I think is good. I don't like using AI for either of those. I think you end up with quite a derivative visual style and writing style. So I commissioned an artist that works in Bristol, a guy called Tom Waterhouse, who I've wanted to work with Tom directly for years and years and years. He's been part of the video game scene for like forever, basically. And he does art work that you might have seen on a bunch of Sega's channels, social media channels, for example. He's done really cool commissions for things like Daytona. I think that was one of his really big ones. I think he's done some Streets of Rage stuff, like lots of really cool things along those lines. He's got this he's got lots of different art styles that he can turn his hand to, but of his styles, one of my particular favorites is this style that feels very, and I don't know how much you're going to know this, but like early 2000s SNK and Capcom fighting game concept art. Like it's basically like,
oh, you had God. Me until concept art.
Yeah, okay.
I was on board until then.
Yeah, that was getting more and more specific with each syllable.
So he does this art style, which is like, I don't want to call it comic book because that's really like just not specific enough. It's this really early 2000s, think Dreamcast era, PS2 era, Capcom, SNK at their finest, putting out like this amazing 2D art.
The golden age.
The golden age of that kind of art for me. And so he makes that style. Like, to me, that's one of his best styles. And so I commissioned him to do some artwork. It was really reasonably priced. I was just like, oh my gosh, I have to do this. I managed to get this full front cover basically made, and it sings. It's amazing. And it's actually, weirdly, it's being used. So I got in touch with the Drive-Thru RPG team, and basically they said, oh, that art is so cool. And I was like, oh, amazing, because I'd commissioned this art and I was really happy with it. And it's currently plastered on the front page of Drive-Thru RPG, which is amazing. It's this really striking red and white and black based on the card colors. And how did I do it? Like, so this was kind of new to me in that, like, commissioning art is something I've only ever done a couple of times, and I'm always really trepidatious about it because I really like working with artists. But the way I like to work with artists is to kind of give them some, I always like to think of it as like pointing them in vaguely the right direction with some solid things of like, okay, it's going to need to be on A5. It needs to be as high res as you can. I'm thinking this style, like here are a bunch of images, this kind of thing. Specifically, I tend to pick the art style from the artist I'm commissioning. Like, I don't go to like an art, like,
and you always pose as well, don't you, for them?
Yeah. I tend to strip off, which most.
Yeah, I've said exclusively nude.
Yeah, exclusively nude modeling.
I've lost a lot of artists that way.
Yeah. But then after that, I kind of just like, it tends to be like, I tend to work with artists where I'm like, I know they're going to do a bang up job. And therefore, like, the amount of like ship steering I need to do is like very gentle nudges of like, oh, I really like this and this and this and this and this. Can we push it slightly more in this direction, rather than like, oh, this needs a rewrite, this needs a rework, you know, because I really don't want to be that guy.
I suppose it's kind of that thing of, as you say, pushing the right direction and then having the faith in them to know you're better at this than I am.
Oh, yeah.
I trust your talent to come up with something.
Damn.
And then I can just, I remember someone saying, talking about kind of acting and stuff, and like, it's the easiest thing in the world to make an adjustment.
Yep.
Let them kind of do as they want, and then it's very easy to then just adjust it ever so slightly to what you want.
Yeah. Like, to me, the thing is that, like, if you like, the best thing you can do for me with artists is spend a bunch of time researching the people that you really want to work with, and then go, right, this is their art style. That is what I want from this piece. And then, as you say, Dan, having that humility to basically go, cool, that is what I want, and I'm going to trust that you know how to get there, because you clearly have done this for a long time. And Tom's an amazing artist. He just knocked it out.
Can I ask you a question, Pete, in terms of, there were two things I really want to ask. One is actually when the art came to you in the process and whether that informed writing.
Mm-hmm.
And secondly, if I'm new to RPGs, can I just pick this up and play it? Is it kind of intuitive for me? I might need to kind of familiarize myself with the lingo in terms of what a GM means here, you know,
sure,
as a dealer. But is this something that you have designed for, you know, seasoned RPG players who kind of already know the ropes? Or is
sure,
this very much showing the ropes to people that have never played an RPG before?
Yeah, absolutely. So the way that I like to think of it is the art does inform the writing to some degree, but the thing that I've found is that having a pretty sturdy idea of what it is that you want from a piece of work, what I like to do is do basically like three quarters of the writing for stuff and then go and then say, okay, artists, start, right? So what I tend to do is whenever I've commissioned stuff, I tend to go, right, around this period of time, I would like to do a piece of art. This is broadly what I'm thinking. Would you be interested in this? They go yes or no. And if it's a yes, then I go, brilliant. I go away and I do a bunch of writing and work and all that sort of stuff. And then I go to them and say, right, we're going to start. Hopefully we can start now. Yep, cool. Here's where we're at now. Here's kind of what I'm thinking. Go for it. And then I've booked them in, so I know I've got them. But I also know the art style that they're going to go with. And also, I'm not like... Because there were lots and lots and lots of revisions on this. And therefore, I wanted to get through loads of revisions to the point where I was just tweaking, as Dan was saying, like tweaking my own wording until... That was mostly what was happening by the time that I was like, okay, Tom, go, right? Like, so it does inform it a bit, though, because it means that when a particularly striking image comes back... So, for example, I actually renamed all the characters when the art came back because I was just like, this is so much better. Like, and because, like, I really, like, for me, I really want to be making games that, like, lower the barrier to entry because, like, ultimately, for me, if you're going to learn a brand new game, if you're going to ask a person to learn a brand new game to play, I think that's an incredible commitment of time. And some games can get away with that when they're massive. So, for example, Pathfinder or Dungeons and Dragons or, you know, I don't know, Dragonbane or whatever. Like, those games will be like, right, this is complex, but hey, this is going to be supported for years and years and years, and it's massive and, you know, all that sort of stuff. Whereas I think for these kinds of games, especially for designers who are kind of new, like me, to be completely, you know, open about it, I think it's easier for me to provide something that is easier to access, to learn and to teach, because that basically means that the chances are somebody will more likely take a punt on it. If somebody who you didn't know came up to you and said, here's 700 pages of rules, I promise you it's the best RPG you've ever played.
That sounds like something you would say to Earth Pete, to be fair. That does like a conversation we've probably had in the past.
That's something I would say to you, but is it something I would say to a potentially paying customer? No, probably not. Because you're my pals and you'll let me get away with that nonsense. So it was good. So Alex, my partner, did help me with the layout with this one. So it's all professionally done in InDesign. It's really good. It's been really lovely. And so basically I'm just sort of watching what happens now. Like, I don't know. Like, it's really interesting to see if it will get...
It's amazing, Gogadin. I'm extremely proud of you. Genuinely.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that a lot. And it is a nice little... it's a nice boost that keeps me wanting to do more. You know what I mean? Like, there's nothing quite like with creative outlets I've found. I'm sure you find this too. To actually put something out there almost like refills your drained bar of like creativity, of just like, oh, it's out there, oh, it's finally done, cool, what's the next thing? Like, whereas like I was getting towards the end of this, I was like, oh my god, when is this done? And I know when I'm like done with one, because I'm always like, that game, I need to get that out the door. Like, I always know, like, okay, I'm done with this, I think, because I'm getting the arse with it. You know, now I'm just like, oh, what are all these amazing other things that I can potentially try and do.
So last episode, you guys all waxed lyrical about your trip to AirCon.
Yep.
And I sat here quietly and let you all chatter away because I wasn't at AirCon.
No. And you were missed.
I didn't join you for that. Oh, thank you very much. What I spent my time doing is catching up on a film that we talked about 3 years ago.
Yes.
And Sam has been going on about for about 3 years, including the weekend before you went to AirCon where he mentioned it about 20 times. And that was the film Dune, which way back when, I mean, I'm sure at AirCon, Sam was going on and on about it to you, Pete, as well.
He literally bought a Dune board game while we were there. So
Exactly. So there we go. So Sam had been going on and on about it, and it had recently appeared on the streaming platforms. So I was like, fine. Like, it was like a few days afterwards, I'd got, like, my wife was out, so I'd got the house to myself, kids are asleep. So I was like, you know what? I'll just put that on. I'll watch Dune. Second film had just come out, so I was like, fine. And I watched it and I was like, okay, Sam and Chris were right. It's a very, very good film. And so, of course, I then very quickly hightailed it out. Well, maybe not that night, but hightailed it out to the cinema to watch the new film out, Dune Part 2. And I don't know anything about Dune. I don't know. All I knew was that there was a film with Sting in it. I didn't know who Sting played. I didn't know anything about it. I knew there was a film in space with Sting in it. And that's it. After kind of the podcast about 3 years ago, I bought the book because you guys had been
amazing,
waxed lyrical so much about it.
Mm-hmm.
I bought the book thinking, okay, well, I'm going to read this. And I said to you guys, brilliant, I'm going to read this and then I'll watch the films. The response I got from Sam was, don't do that.
Yeah.
The books are not good. Just watch the film. And I was like, no, fine. So I've still got the book. I mean, Sam's not here, so I can say whatever he wants. He swore an F and blinded really? All
wow.
about it.
Wow.
He was, I mean, there's things Jeffin. I couldn't say here. Yeah, he was awful.
He was saying that Frank Herbert.
Yeah.
No arms with Herbert.
Anyway, I'm not going to go over kind of my thoughts on the first film, a film that kind of obviously Chris and Sam so eloquently discussed.
Mm-hmm.
I really wanted to see it at the cinema based on the first film I'd seen on the TV. I really wanted to see it at the cinema on a big screen. I couldn't go to an IMAX. There's not really one close to me. So I had to settle for a regular old cinema where I picked the biggest screen I could find in the cinema, sat in the middle. So I was there in all its glory. And it is really like an epic sci-fi fantasy film that you don't get come around very often. And the feeling I constantly had to it, and this goes through both films, is there is such a commitment to the vision that kind of the director has. The look of the entire film, there is kind of no point where that vision is kind of broken. There are so many different times where they take really broad strokes with it, and there's a whole sequence which is basically black and white, but it works in this weird world that they've created, and it's the story progresses of Paul Atreides' journey and become this kind of prophesized character, and it continues now this route of how does he become that? Is that who he's become? Is the prophecy real? Is it not? What do the different factions all want, and what do they need, and how will they go about it? And there's political machinations. But I was just overwhelmed by kind of the force of the film. And I'm sure, Chris, you kind of felt that with the first one. I think you've seen the second one, so you may feel it there. That kind of force of the film, that wave kind of takes you over and just sweeps you up with it, like a great, great fantasy film can. It's a funny film at times. Like, there are absolute nods to like Monty Python. Like there is a very clear reference to Monty Python, Life of Brian.
Well,
Chris, how do you feel? Because I watched it kind of back to back. How did you feel watching that second part, kind of 3 years removed from that original experience?
Well, it was really interesting because it is a second part. It picks up straight after the first one, literally. And usually with a sequel, particularly one which has only appeared like quite a you said it's about 3 years, Dan. It's been about 3 years since part one. You'd expect something of a little bit of a recap. You know, if you think back to The Two Towers in Lord of the Rings, we don't just pick up where we left off. We actually go back and we see Gandalf versus the Balrog.
Yeah.
This one picks up where you left off. There's an assumption there that you'll know the first one and you can just carry on. And that acts, you know, that's in its favor, really. It is not doing, there is no Galadriel monologue at the beginning. There's no title crawl that explains, you know, like Star Wars, for example, at the beginning here. There is a trust and a faith in the audience that anything they need to know will come to them. And they just need to accept that and just breathe it in and breathe it out. So you never really feel the running time of this film. I would suggest that it's not as strong as the first one, but that I think that's by dint of the fact that it's the second one. It's no longer, hasn't got that sheen of The Cult of the New, say, for example. But for me, one thing I really noticed more so this time was the sound design. Pete, I cannot explain to you that sensation of almost like ASMR, the sound of people walking on sand. You know, you can hear the crunch of the spice which is in the sand, which is obviously this this drug that is in the sand. It's almost like brown sugar that is the fuel system that runs this whole galaxy. But you think, okay, this is a film that ostensibly takes place in a desert. That is going to get pretty bland. Villeneuve, the director, manages to make the desert this most terrifying, majestic, sublime, and beautiful landscape that becomes the character of the whole film. And there are similarities, Pete, between you and this director.
Sure.
Because the way that Villeneuve works is he writes a full script, he then storyboards all the script, and then he looks at his storyboards and then rewrites his script.
Sure.
So similar to kind of you with your RPG and the work with the artist, you rename characters, you made other decisions there. That's what Villeneuve does. And that's why every single shot feels like there's this kind of painterly quality to it that makes it feel lived in. You can kind of see the brushstrokes of it. There's no green screen-itis. It feels real. I don't know what else to say, really. And on an IMAX screen where there is nowhere to hide, literally nowhere to hide,
that's cool.
You know how where you watch remastered films of old and you can see actually from this angle, from this shot here, this reverse shot, it's actually raining, and they were fine with that because they knew the audience wouldn't be able to see that. But on this Blu-ray or 4K, you can see the rain. It's just there. There's nowhere to hide in IMAX. And oh my word, it is jaw-dropping. Jaw-dropping. And there is no flim-flam. Villeneuve knows that this novelization, this series, was so highly influential, it does not need to flex. Yeah, George Lucas, yes, we informed Star Wars. Yeah, we got that. Yeah, lovely. So many kind of fantasy or science fiction, or science fiction fantasy, I should say, has been informed by Dune. And you get a sense, yeah, it is. This, yeah, it does. There's nothing really over the top here, almost to a fault. Like the final battle of part two felt to some degree a little bit muted, only because I wanted more of it. Like,
right.
There are some incredible moments in this film, and it never loses sight of the kind of the human, that sensation of a single human in this vast desert planet of Arrakis.
I think there is something, and it's with Denis Villeneuve and someone like Christopher Nolan with the IMAX and stuff. When we've so become used to the Marvel films, the DC films, these massive big budget action films, and I'm not dumping on them because they are great in their own way, but these kind of big budget AAA films where so much of it is just green screen, mainly because what you're actually showing can't really be done with a real life thing. There is just something so tangible, and you can see when you can see an actual location there. So when he's filming in the desert, you can tell it's the desert and it feels different because the way the light hits everything and refracts and all that stuff, the way people move and all that stuff, you can't necessarily always create that in a set and a studio environment. So you know, and that's why when you see some of the stuff that Christopher Nolan does and you can see it's a physical thing, I'm seeing, that is always to me so much more interesting to see what a director can do using the tools of filmmaking, not the tools of a computer, but the tools of what can I do in camera. If you can film something in camera, it is always going to be 1,000% better than something that can be created digitally afterwards. Not to say that there's not great value in digital effects, because there absolutely is, but there is something different about seeing something. And when you've got something like Dune, which is sci-fi in the extreme, it's not kind of, it wears itself on its sleeve. There's no kind of hiding away from that. The fact that he's able to do the amount that he has in camera, and at no point does it feel like, oh, that's a set, that's a location that I can work out, okay, that is, it all always feels extraterrestrial. It always feels like you are on another planet.
Sure.
I also quite like that, Pete, you know how in the book there's a period where Lady Jessica just disappears for the novel?
Yeah.
And then comes back and you find out what happened to them, you stick with Lady Jessica. And it is fascinating because one of the reasons why I find June fascinating as a story is because the setup seems to kind of follow that playbook that we've seen in subsequent stories of the hero's journey. And you can imagine, you've got Paul Atreides, he's come for the family Atreides, he's come to this planet of Arrakis, and suddenly he becomes the Muad'Dib, which is becomes essentially the rebel leader of the Fremen tribe and leads them against, you know, the Harkonnens and this huge vast revolution. The way Villeneuve does the film is he doesn't shy away from the fact that actually, and this isn't really a spoiler if you've read the book, he's not depicted really as a hero. That antagonistic quality. Same with Lady Jessica. At the end of the film, there's a kind of a slightly bitter taste in your mouth. And it introduces that nuance of complexity, thinking, well, hang on, who or what am I rooting for here? What is this film about? Is it actually a film about, oh, we've vanquished evil, the baddies that are clearly baddies, look at them, got their comeuppance, and good will reign supreme? Or actually, is there something else happening? It's a bit more nuanced. That is one of the reasons why I think this is such a really interesting story. And Villeneuve has really honed in on that massively. Can I just do a little shout out to a podcast that I appeared on recently?
Yes, please. Ooh. Please do.
So I appeared on, of time recording, the latest episode of Two Can Play That Game.
We like Two Can Play That Game.
We love Two Can Play That Game. You may remember that we were very lucky to have on the podcast a few episodes back, Pete from Two Can Play That Game.
Mm-hmm.
And Two Can Play That Game is a podcast that's been going for a number of years now. It's hosted by Pete and Andrew. And I love this as a premise, particularly for someone such as myself who plays a lot of two-player games, to have a podcast that is solely devoted to two-player games. And they are very strict with this. It's incredible. They are very adamant. And they said that they only have one other friend, and that is each other. So they're very, very strict. So I was very, very lucky to be there as an acquaintance there. And I was there to talk about Kyriai the Jewel, which is obviously a game that we spoke about on a previous episode of the podcast. I had an absolute blast. And if you want to kind of go and hear that game being spoken about in much, much more detail than we had time to do on our respective pod with these two fine people, then I recommend you do. You can find that on any podcast platform, really. Two Can Play That Game. Also, we had Pete on the show. Pete from Two Can Play That Game, I should say.
There can be only one per show.
Yeah, one per show. We made that clear because you weren't able to make it that time, Pete. Mm-hmm. And Pete came on and spoke about Undertale and convinced me to get that game along with
Pretty
Sam.
Good.
I may have said in the episode I guested on, Pete, that I would duel you if I had a choice. I was asked who would I duel out of the four of us, and I said you, because generally you would be the most unpredictable.
Yeah. I mean,
surely you would want somebody predictable, though.
I'd just be a laugh, really. It'd be a good laugh.
Yeah, it'd just be good fun, wouldn't it? Yeah, exactly. Also, you want somebody who you have a fighting chance against, really. And I'm probably the guy.
Yeah.
I don't think you could take Sam.
Sam is scrappy.
I don't know if, I mean, Dan maybe.
I'm quite
but
lazy though.
Yeah, but you're like Snorlax.
But Dan,
you
look,
are lazy.
I mean, Pete, look at that face. Look at Dan's face. I couldn't hit that face.
No, well, exactly.
I couldn't hit
therefore
that face,
you don't.
Whereas
you
don't,
yours. Yeah, imminently punchable.
I've got like a tortoise and the hare style thing.
But yeah, so if you, I'd give them a listen. Don't just listen to the episode I was in. What I love is that they're covering so many great games at the moment. There's Sale on there, which they've convinced me to buy, which I want to buy, and I'm gutted. I didn't pick it up when we were at AirCon, and I should have done. They talk about Clask, which is a game I'm desperate to play. They talk about Beer and Bread, which Sam owns, which I really, really enjoyed playing as well. So check them out. Two Can Play That Game. Had a lot of fun.
Yep.
And thank you. If you're listening, Thank you for having me on. I think they're intending to collect the whole set, potentially. So it might be Pete and Dan at some point in the future.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, for sure, if they want to complete the collection. We will have links to the episode that you are on and also the episode of Staying In that they appeared on in the show notes.
Brilliant. Are we going to have the link to your wonderful artist as well in the show notes, Peter?
Yes, we will. I'll also, for shameless self-promotion, I will put a link so you can go and find the actual thing itself. I know, it's terrible, isn't it? We're far too British for any of this nonsense. And what else will we have links to? I mean, as always, we will have links to all the things we've discussed on the podcast. So in your podcast player of choice that you have right now, there will be show notes. You can go and look at them right now. And they should be interactable. So you can go and see things
Pete's
like...
Pete's going to put a joke in there for you.
Now you've said that, I actually have to do it. Yeah, all right. There will be a joke in there. Okay, there you go. But there will also be a link to Chris's amazing Spotify playlist, which is really, really good, filled with lovely atmospheric music to enjoy various different things to. Will you be putting something in from the...
Oh, definitely. Hans Zimmer, of course. I mean, June.
Of course you will.
June is just so hypnotic. Definitely.
I'd also like to hear a little bit of something nice from Mirage.
Oh, yes.
If there's something
definitely
good in there.
Oh, definitely.
We will have links to... we will obviously link to the trailer for June 2, if you've not seen it yet. All those other good things that what we have talked about in the podcast. I think that's pretty much everything that we put in there, isn't it? Yeah, pretty much. Pretty much.
Yeah.
I think so. All right.
Yeah. I mean, a very deserty episode.
Yeah. Sandy.
Yeah. Do you know what else has got sand, Dan?
So.
Where would you... Yeah. I'll see you there.
See you on it.
Sand the beach.